a joint meeting between the Standing Committee on Appropriations and the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. We will be co-chairing the meeting. At some point, I'll just do the opening remarks and then hand over to the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. Are you happy with that arrangement? Happy. All right. Do we all have a copy of the agenda in front of us? It has been circulated. I know there's an extra copy here if you don't have Mr. Okay. There's one for you. There's another one. No, there's another extra copy. All right. All right. In terms of the agenda, we are on item number one, which is opening and welcome. I'll request that we observe a moment of silence for prayer or meditation. Thank you very much. Honorable members, my co-chair, honorable members, I would like to welcome the honorable members, but also to a special word of welcome goes to the Auditor General, Mr. Makwetu and his team. Thank you so much for making time to come and make us aware of issues that in our oversight we should focus on in ensuring that there are corrections in these areas that you would, you know, be emphasizing in your presentation. I would also like to welcome the hard-working support staff. Our warm welcome and greetings to our esteemed guests. This is an open meeting. We're a democratic government. Every time we meet, we do invite the public. We inform the public with one sole interest that, you know, they can join, come and sit and join and listen. Thank you very much if you are here. The objective of the meeting is to receive and discuss the national and provincial audit outcomes of 2017 and 2018 financial year. The Office of the Auditor General of South Africa is a Chapter 9 institution created to strengthen South Africa's constitutional democracy. It is crucial to the basic functioning of Parliament. Today we get to see and reflect on how departments and entities used public resources to deliver services to the people of South Africa. The presentation will answer the following key questions. When using public resources, did departments and entities stick to the principles of efficiency, effectiveness, and economy? Did public servants comply with applicable legislations and regulations? Is government on track in bringing about a better life for all? As they spend the money, is the value for money? Are public servants helping government to reach the goals set out in the National Development Plan, because we are about the National Development Plan and the budget is talking to that. So as we await answers to these questions, I invite honorable members to carefully listen and constructively engage the presentation by the AG. Thank you very much. I'm now going to hand over to my co-chair.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair. Comrade, welcome. Auditor General, I think the objective or the purpose of the meeting has already been outlined. I want to thank you for making time to personally come and present this to Parliament. As we are sitting here, the people who make use the most of the work that you do. Our planning cycle starts after this presentation because it assists us in prioritizing what should come and what should we prioritize. I do want to reaffirm, as you already know, that we as Parliament have passed the amendment to your Act. It is now with the Executive to sign it into law so that some of the things that you are going to lament about today could no longer be issues of lamentations, but you would actually be telling us what action you have taken. So we hope that the President will sign that into law so that it can enhance your work. But we are in your hands. Comrades, will allow the Auditor General to make his presentation, and thereafter we will... We will allow comrades to ask questions for clarity, not substance, because I think the substance will be answered by the departments themselves when they appear before us. But before I give the AG, can we just check, Ntombi, any apologies, as well as the appropriations, any apologies? Comrade Mente? Yeah, from our side, that's the only apology we have. From appropriations, are there any apologies?
We have Honorable Gabaza's apology to leave the meeting just after 12.
All right, I'm sure we'll be long done by then. Okay. No, that's fine. Let me hand over to the AG. Comrade Kekane and Comrade Chilwane are at school. Okay, that's fine. Okay, Mr. AG, send over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to members of both committees. I'm told that the IT department is busy fixing something or other, so I'm not going to be able to get the slide presentation on the screen. I'm told also that the copy of the presentation has been circulated to members. So I'm going to be going through this presentation as you have it in front of you. As the chairs have already indicated, this is a first indication, as it were, of the audit outcomes that we are busy preparing to launch for the month of November. However, what you have in front of us as the audit report of the audits that we completed in July this year for the 17-18 year is the status as we have analyzed it up to now. I just wanted to say also that we are reporting here on the audit outcomes of about 434 departments nationally and provincially. That means all of the national departments, all of the provincial departments together with their entities. They add up in total if you look at the numbers that we are analyzing for this year to 434. 258 of those are at national and 176 are provincial departments across all nine provinces together with their entities. So that is just for some perspective in terms of the total picture. So as I go straight to the first slide where we analyze and explain the different types of audit outcomes. I think it will be worth reminding members, as we see what is on page 2, that the color coding that we are going to be going through these audit outcomes is going to be consistent with the descriptions that you see on page 2, where the green annotation is in respect of those entities and departments with unqualified financial statements with no findings. And so what you are presenting today is no different to the processes that are currently underway in various portfolio committees where each department is being engaged in the BRRR process. And our teams are also spread out across these portfolios as of yesterday, getting into the detail of some of the nitty-gritty detail pertaining to every single entity. So what I'm going to be presenting here is not going to contain that detail, because that detail is already presented in the annual reports, is already presented in the financial statements and the audit report. So what we have for today is really a cross-cutting analysis of the key trends that we have picked up as we analyzed these financial statements as we concluded them. So there won't be anything specific to department such and such and entity such and such, because all of that is already being taken care of via the BRRR process. But also a lot of that detail will also emerge when we finally present and table the consolidated general report on audit outcomes, which is a process we normally undertake around the month of November after we've completed the whole analysis nationally. But most importantly also, we, while doing this, are also interacting with the different provinces to take them through the specific issues pertaining to their provincial audit outcomes. So that is the level of detail to which we're going to be going in today. But I think you'll walk away from here having a good idea about what are the key issues that the audit this particular financial year has picked up. And perhaps I thought, Chair, as we go through this, because I think, as you have mentioned, you also spoke about the amendment to the Public Audit Act, and I think there will be some relevance to some specific sections of the PFMA, because most of the time when we present these audit outcomes and make certain recommendations, we from our side tend to do this having read and gone through the PFMA. So what we normally do then is to highlight the extent to which the PFMA has been deviated from. So it's normally things that are already in law as prescribed that we are reporting on. Let me just quickly touch on a few of these. If one looks at the accountability system, as well as who is accountable to do what in respect of matters of financial management, in respect of the maintenance of systems, in respect of issues of internal control, that is clearly laid out in an existing law in the PFMA. That is section 38, 39, and 40, those three sections. But if you are looking for what should be done in the event that nobody carries out the expected control activities as set out in section 39, 38, and 40, you will find in section 81, 83, and 86 of the PFMA what are the legislated remedial actions that need to be pursued should there be persistent failure in managing finances the way they are prescribed in the law. So if one thinks about those six sections of the PFMA, you'll almost come to the conclusion that no wonder there was a need for this amendment of the Public Audit Act, because it's almost an amendment that is trying to enable the activation of those six sections, in essence, of the PFMA. So what we're introducing, as it were, in the Public Audit Act is nothing completely new. It is just new to the extent that it creates the capacity and the strength and the power to activate what is already in an existing piece of legislation, and that is the PFMA. So I thought it's important to have that context as we think about what this new amendment to the Public Audit Act. I think it was just a creative way of trying to find implementation mechanisms to make sure that accounting officers do what the law requires And that's really what that is about. And I think what I'll be going through these audit outcomes also will be an illustration of how we have veered off the expectations of the PFMA as far as Section 38, 39, and 40 are concerned. And I think if you read them in detail, you'll realize that, in fact, the law almost preempted some of these things way back when it was promulgated in 1999. So these are not new, Chair, and I thought I'll probably also try to make and reemphasize that point, you know, that sometimes we make it look like we are creating new laws, but we are probably creating capacity to make the existing laws work. And I think that's what is substantially the essence of what is in our public auditor amendment. So this detail is in essence then about saying, had everybody paid attention to what the role of an accounting officer is, we probably would have avoided having to have some of these alarming numbers that are constantly coming out as part of the audit report process. Now let's get to it. On page 3 now, the other stuff I spoke about is not in any pages, but I think it's also as relevant for the presentation. If we start on page 3 of the presentation where we speak about the plan, do, check, and act cycle, we've exposed this to members over a couple of years where we have identified the kind of plans and actions that need to be put in place in the areas of accounting and financial management. And our overall conclusion, even at this stage, is that part of what we are experiencing in terms of these negative audit outcomes is that the basic systems of internal control and financial management and supervision are generally not being observed. And hence, the accountability for the finances sometimes is not in place, leading to the negative audit outcomes, as I will show it. So that's what the page 3 of the presentation does. It almost in summary says that the instruments that are required to reverse the financial management weaknesses are not being applied diligently across a number of departments, nor is the supervision that is required and monitoring by the assurance providers being put in place to make sure that corrective steps are being taken. The illustration of this is on the next page, where we say that if you look at, for example, the plan part of the cycle, where we say that you need to plan to action the audit findings that were given to you as a department or entity in the previous year. So here we're saying that about 44% of those action plans regressed slightly in about 44% of the entities that we looked at. The usefulness of performance information and targets improved from what it was last year. And I think there's clear evidence in a lot of the audits that we've signed off that a lot of effort is being put into making sure that they report as accurately as they can, and hence you see the improvement from last year. So there's quite a significant number of departments and entities, as depicted on this page, that have spent a lot of time trying to make sure that at least the performance indicators that they are reporting on are consistent with what they have planned. In the area of internal control overall, there's not been much change. However, notably, it is important to see that in this same analysis, the controls over the information technology environment have regressed. We have found about almost 9% of the total of the entities we've analyzed have had good controls in the IT environment, which means that our IT environment is constantly exposed, meaning that the different modules of financial management that are hosted in an IT environment, if the controls are as weak as they are described in this report, then it means that those systems are vulnerable. In a number of instances, they are vulnerable to inappropriate access. They are vulnerable to people that could make changes into the IT control environment without it being detected. And that means that you can easily process transactions in an online environment, successfully without anybody picking it up as it happens. So that's a major vulnerability. So it's almost like saying that the key to the bank was left by the door. That's effectively what that IT control weakness is. It's almost a case of the key to the bank vault was left by the entrance door. So all you need to do is just to struggle getting into the bank, but otherwise you'll make your way to where the nodes are. So that's what is important about that area of the IT control weakness. And I think it is something that needs to be focused on. Right. I move to the next slide, number 5. The one that has got those arrows, blue and navy. I'll explain them quickly. But before I do that, on the same page, if you look at the top left of that page, that's where we show the different years of audit outcomes. The numbers that we're showing there are the number of departments and entities. So if you look at that page across, that's what that 434 is coming from. It's the sum of all of those blue, red, pink, purple, yellow, green, those colors. So those are the number of departments and entities that have achieved these kind of audit outcomes. Let's just quickly take a look at the green one. The green one being the clean audits, unqualified with no significant findings. When we started off in terms of this analysis, 2014-15, you can see how the numbers are, but certainly over the last 4 years, the current year in terms of clean audits has shown an all-time low in terms of that we have only 99 from last year's 129 departments and entities that had clean audits. So the level of clean audits has unfortunately regressed, as well as the total, if you look at the total number of unqualified audits, being the yellow and the green. On that top line there, it's about 295. Last year, it was 314. So we can see that there are reversals of audit outcomes that were previously achieved in the previous year as well as the year before. So clearly this year's audit outcomes, as depicted here, there's about, as I say, 99 in total that have achieved clean audits. Now let's look at the circle that we are putting out here. If I just look quickly at the top, if you look at the top, the one that's headed clean audit outcomes, I just want to explain how the graph works first. If you look at the target where there's the maroon at the center, the maroon at the center, honorable members, is almost the ideal situation, the 100%. So what you are saying in this slide here is that if everybody, if all of the 434 had done their financial management accurately and transparently, had reported on their performance accurately and the information was found to be useful, had complied with all of the laws and regulations, whether it is about submitting financial statements as well as complying with supply chain management. If that was the situation, all of these entities would have been plotted at the center. That's where the center of accountability is, as it were, at 100%. But where we are now, if you look at audit outcomes for 2017-2018, which is shown at the top by the navy color, it's sitting at 25%. So we've got a whole 75% of departments and entities that still need to do a significant amount of work to be able to produce reliable financial statements that are without qualification. In the previous year, we had 31% of them. Hence, as you see, the reversal from 129 to 99. That's why we are now sitting at 25% of them, a quarter of them, that are now showing audits that are without qualification and no significant findings on internal control. And the same goes for the area of no findings on compliance with legislation. There were about 36% of them that did not have findings last year, and this year they are about 28%. So we still have a huge gap, but also this is signifying a reversal because the percentage of those that have no findings on compliance is now declining, which means the ones who have findings on compliance in the current year is about 72%. that have got findings on compliance. And a lot of these compliance findings are the ones that give rise to the matters that often attract the headlines, I think, as we saw last week, when many of the departments were submitting their financial statements. One of the things that was prominent was the extent to which many had incurred levels of irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So when we look at this graph and it's gravitating towards the center, then we must know that things are looking good. But the further away it is from the center, the more worried we should be about the state of financial management across the system. And I think that's what effectively that graph is trying to illustrate to us. Just on that page as well, Chairs, you'll notice that the blue, which is the audits that are outstanding, audits that have not been submitted by the cutoff date for signature as well as for clearance of audit matters, was in the past, if one looks at in the past, it used to be just an exception, two or three, and there were specific reasons for many of these. The number has now become 41 entities that have not been able to come forth in respect of submission, or if they submitted, there were a significant amounts of delays because they were either contesting certain findings that were made in an audit, which we believe is a natural process of any audit. However, there were those that were contesting for the sake of contesting because they did not have any alternative evidence to show. So they are not in here because either they didn't like the kind of audit outcome that was proposed, or they made it look like there's still a little bit more work that they need to do, which might trigger a different conclusion. They still haven't come forth. Now, the reality is that the more we have those that have not come forth for submission, the more risky it is, because we absolutely do not have an idea as to what their final position is. But also importantly, Chair, to note in this year's cycle, in that 41, there are many that are struggling with issues of going concern, because the number of years of deficiencies in financial management, deficiencies in financial control, have almost resulted in a situation where they are now in a financially bad position. They are not able to pay their creditors on time. Their costs and expenditures are starting to exceed the revenues that they are able to generate. The ability to collect amounts outstanding in the form of receivables, their ability to collect has declined, meaning that some of their debts had to be impaired to show for the fact that they are not going to be able to collect all of it. So the financial management and the financial health risk has started becoming a big issue, and many of them were not comfortable to leave with an audit conclusion that is reflecting that situation. Hence our saying, they are trying to see what it is they can do in this late stage to try and fix that. So I guess the essence of the message is, Chair, that a combination of the lack of internal control as far as financial management is concerned, which gets left unchecked over a number of years, sometimes results in a situation where the financial risk becomes very sharp. And what happens when there is a financial risk? The reason some of them can't submit is because they are waiting for somebody to assist them, either through a guarantee or some injection that might need to be made in that entity in order for it to continue to operate on the assumption of a going concern. So that is the consequential impact of some of these issues pertaining to financial health risk. So having said that, the next slide is just being focused on departments, slide number 6. Clearly the message is almost similar. However, it is worth noting also that on this slide number 6, if one looks at financially unqualified financial statements, the departments generally are doing a good job of managing the financial management discipline in essence. Hence the 80% from last year, which has now gone backwards to about 78%. But it's still a strong showing to say As far as the discipline of financial management is concerned, at least the departments are doing their best. The areas where they are failing is largely in the findings with compliance with legislation. As you can see on this slide, they are way behind insofar as complying with legislation, but have got the necessary technical capacity to produce accurate financial statements, even though some of them have got to be fixed after the submission for the audit. Now, in terms of the slide number 8 now, the last number, slide number 7 is the same as the previous two, but this one just focuses on public entities. And perhaps it's clear now that the bulk of these that have not made submissions, Chair, for your own tracking, if one takes that 41, 8 were for the departments, and then the 33 that have not made submission are largely the entities. That's where the likes of Denel are. That's where the likes of SAA are. That's where the likes of SA Express, Safcon, and many others that you will see, we've got a list of them as well, where we have highlighted individually which ones have not submitted that make up that total. So I'm sure you might be keen to follow up as well on those ones. And then for the next slide, Chair, is where we show the outstanding audits. Now, those 8 departments that we said are outstanding, but since when they were outstanding at the time up to now, many have already come forward to submit those financial statements that were outstanding. So what we are showing on the audit opinion of those subsequently finalized is the final audit opinion that was issued on each one of them. An example, the first one being the Environmental Affairs and Development Planning Department of the Western Cape. The finalization of this audit was delayed, but after it was finalized, it ended up with a clean audit. While the Department of Energy is still outstanding, as you can see the blue, Environmental Affairs submitted and ended up with an adverse opinion, and so it goes with the rest of the others that have also submitted subsequently, but ended up with an audit opinion as shown on the slide. An example on the bottom here, the Office of the Premier of the Northwest was outstanding, but subsequently ended up with a qualified opinion. So there has been some progress as far as the submissions are concerned. So we can say here that as we speak now, that number 8 departments that had not submitted at a particular date, as we speak today, there are only 3 that have now not submitted. 5 of them have subsequently been signed off. So it's effectively Energy, Social Development Northwest, and Health Northwest in terms of departments that have not submitted as we speak today. So 2 in the Northwest and the Department of Energy. And the Department of Energy, we are, in fact, as late as 2 days ago, we're in discussion with them to try and address some of those matters that caused those accounts not to be finally put to the system. And then insofar as the public entities, Chair, for the same depiction that I've done with slide number 8, it is all of these entities. I think we were not able to list all 33 of them, but these are just some of the significant ones that have that were outstanding according to the 2017-18 blue across all of them. And you can just track the ones that remain blue that are the ones that have not submitted. SAA and its subsidiaries. The audit has not been finalized yet. SA Express, Denel, and many of those that are listed on that page. But some of them, after they submitted, ended up with qualified audits, like PRASA in this case. PRASA is now in the system, has been submitted, but has ended up with a qualified opinion, which is no different to how their audit ended in 2016-2017. Chairs, on the map here, the number 10 slide, if you look at each of the provinces and you look at what has happened year on year across the provinces, the picture emerging is quite clear that certain provinces remained with almost similar audit outcomes if one looks at the likes of Limpopo, Gauteng, Northern Cape, and Western Cape. they are predominantly similar if one compares to what the total departments in those provinces ended up in their audit outcomes year on year. I mean, in Gauteng, evidence is that nothing changed. There were 12 that were clean in the previous year, in the current year, the same. 11 of them were unqualified with findings, and the current year, the same. But what is significant to note there is that all of the departments in Gauteng are unqualified. The same situation that they were in the previous year. They are all unqualified. But the number in total, in terms of unqualified with findings and unqualified with no findings, is still exactly almost the same. Northern Cape, similar picture. Changing of the deck, as it were, between the clean that were there before and then the one that reversed to become unqualified with findings. So the Northern Cape, one can say, has had a reversal one, but overall the picture is no different. And the same goes with the Western Cape. However, it is worth looking at two provinces, Chair, here, where I'm sure the color strikes you when you look at it as well, the Northwest and the Free State, where there's still quite a significant number of departments that have been qualified in that they didn't pass the test in respect of due diligence around the management of their finances and reporting on them, because we now have 8 that were qualified, 4 that were disclaimed, 3 that are still outstanding. Those 3 are the ones that we looked at just now. But the picture from last year, if one looks at it, it's almost looking like it's even deteriorating from where it was in the 16-17 year in the Northwest. And coming to the Free State as well, the Free State did not have any disclaimed audits, but in the current year there's just 3 that have come up, lost anything that was previously clean in terms of the audit outcomes of that province. And so the issue is that there's quite a significant number of departments where the financial management and financial accounting discipline has failed in the area of Northwest as well as the Free State. And these are the number of departments as shown here that evidence that. However, the other departments, Chair, is a stagnant picture, not the desirable picture. The fact that they didn't change from where they were last year does not mean they were in a good place. They just remained in the bad place where they were in respect of the number of departments that continue to be qualified. You see many of those are still quite a number in KwaZulu-Natal and in Mpumalanga as well as Limpopo. So that is the picture as far as the provinces are concerned. You almost have a situation where others are doing very badly, but others are still doing bad in the same way that they did not do well in the previous year. So that's really what the overall picture is as far as that element of the different provinces are concerned. Coming to the national side, Chair, that's where the bulk of also these outstandings. You'll see that in the provinces, barring the outstanding audits in the Northwest, perhaps one in the Western Cape, other than that, the rest of those that are outstanding are in the national portfolio. And you would have seen the likes of Denel, SAA, SAPO, and many other entities which are national entities that have not come forth for finalization of their audits. As well as the evident decline in the number of clean audits also at a national level is another glaring picture here. And the reality is that, Chair, even though we still have about 37 of them outstanding as we speak in terms of the national portfolios, the chances are that even if these 37 are concluded, they are unlikely to be clean. So one can argue that the 56 that you are seeing here of clean audits as we speak now is unlikely to change. Because if it was going to change, then the ones that are outstanding would have submitted long ago, because I'm sure they would be wanting to be known first as having achieved clean audits. But the fact that there's a contestation and there are issues pertaining to fixing certain elements suggests that they are below the clean anyway. So even if they were completed, they will be below the green bar. So that is the national picture, Chair, and of course this picture is going to be translated in the narrative that will be in the general report on audit outcomes. But here what we're doing is just to try and make it easy to get a sense of what are the areas that need to be focused on, in which parts of the cycle and the system, as it were. So if you go to page 12, because I'm going to skip this one, I've spoken at length about the issues of the transparent reporting on performance. Maybe let's go straight to what are the things that are causing a lot of the areas of non-compliance. I'm sure you will recall from the previous slides that that area of compliance with legislation, there's only about 25 to 35% of those that comply with legislation, which means that about 65% of these entities have not complied with a number of instruments that are geared towards transparent financial reporting. So the area, firstly, is the area of material misstatements and submitted financial statements. Let's just draw links between this: the management of procurement, the prevention of unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure, payment not settled within 30 days. All of these things are what is described in Section 38, 39, and 40. These are the things that are already set out in the PFMA, which are required to be done by accounting officers as a routine exercise that they need to put in place in order to prevent all of these things from happening. So you can already see that this is perhaps trying to say what was the law intending to do with these things when it assigned the responsibility for them to the accounting officer. And the evidence is that there's quite a significant number of them where major financial statements, when they are submitted, they come with significant errors, they come with things that need to be changed, which means that the reliability of that financial information, as well as the exercise of the control disciplines within the departments, is not at a place where you can say you can rely on the information coming out of that environment. Then the next category, which is in total about 169 entities and departments as we evaluated them, was the major findings in respect of management of procurement and or contracts. And these are the areas, Chair, that have triggered the extent of irregular expenditure as we have reported it. Because many of them, if they did not manage procurement, they did not manage contracts, then those amounts where they make payments will sometimes find their way into the area of irregular expenditure. Then there also the prevention of unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure is also another area of deviation from the prescribed standards. Mm-hmm. Then the last one being the payment not settled within 30 days for suppliers. So these are pretty much a repetition and spread in quite a number of institutions. If one looks at the in numbers and brackets, reflect the number of departments and entities where those significant findings were found. And then if we break down the area of supply chain management, Chair, we've also made findings in the report where we said that because of missing and incomplete information for certain of the procurement processes, we were not able to audit procurement to the extent of about 6.5 billion, and largely because of missing or incomplete information. Because our audit effort, as well as the conclusions that we reach on the audit, are largely based on the evidence that we are able to inspect, as well as access to supporting documentation and other corroborative evidence that may be found to be necessary. Awards to employees without complying with legislation is still prevalent to the extent of about 265 million in respect of the expenditures on the supply chain management was in relation to awards made to employees without complying. And there were also quite a number of areas of uncompetitive and unfair procurement processes in areas, almost more than half of all of the audits had those findings. So on the supply chain management side of things, if one looks at the same slide, only about 32% had no findings in total of the entities we audited. while 43% had material findings, which is in total the 169. And that's where I guess the bulk of the supply chain management deficiencies will be found. They will be found among 43% of the total entities that we audited, and they make in total about 169. So it's quite a sizable population from which to choose. I guess that's the message. If one wanted to choose which ones to track, which ones to follow up from an oversight point of view, they are in that category. Now let's get to the irregular expenditure, Chair. The irregular expenditure total as audited in the 2017-2018 audit is 45.5 billion, comparing to last year's 45.3. So that's the audited number. Any other number is created. I just wanted to make that point because it's important that we take this irregular expenditure from the numbers that have been audited, because that's where it normally comes from. However, if you remember, there were those audits that were not finalized at the time that we arrived at the 45.5. And you'll see on this page where we say audits subsequently finalized, the irregular expenditure for those audits was about 4.8. So one can technically say that the total based on financial statements that were audited at that date plus those that were audited or that were submitted subsequently, which is 4.8 plus the 45.5. So in total, we basically are talking about a total irregular expenditure of, let's say, to round it off, 50 billion. Yeah. 45.5 plus 4.8 billion. B.
45,000 million is 45 billion.
Yeah. 45 billion. B. Billion plus 4.8. So we are rounding that off to 50. Now, in terms of the irregular expenditure, we cannot add the ones that have not been finalized, because we'll just be estimating, because it's not based on a clear conclusion arising from an audit test. So the temptation sometimes is to add the ones that have not been submitted using last year's irregular expenditure and assumptions related to the fact that it might still be the same. But the point is, statutorily, in terms of the audit and accounts, the total irregular expenditure that has found itself into the financial statements as audited for this year is sitting at around 50 billion. So I think it's important to...
A point of clarity on that. You're talking about 45 billion, but if I understand it correctly, that is with what you've already audited. So it would be substantially higher if you had completed the entire process and everyone had submitted their audit statements and everything. Am I correct?
Provided those that have not been signed come with a substantially big irregular expenditure. We can assume that they will have some level of irregular spend, but we cannot quantify it. And that's why we've always left it out for those that have not been. Otherwise, we will make assumptions and then we will never know what the right number. So we always try and surface the number that we know about and make sure that we track those ones that still have to submit. For example, SAA, we don't know what their total irregular expenditure is going to be because things are still being finalized. We don't know what it's going to be in Denel. We don't know what it's going to be in the others, including the other smaller entities in other departments which may not have large budgets as well. So we try to stay away from estimating, otherwise this thing might not be a reliable figure. But this one is based on signed statutory accounts, and that's the number that we believe needs to be used.
Yeah, no, let's continue the presentation. We will come back to questions of clarity later.
All right. So, and in essence, Chair, I think let's just also break this down. That this irregular expenditure, the significant part of it, almost 84% of it, is caused by non-compliance with SCM regulations. The biggest portion of the irregular expenditure is because the buying process, as well as the process of procuring goods and services, is not always adhered to. And this shows itself through the likes of procurement without competitive bidding, among others. Non-compliance with procurement process requirements, as well as non-compliance with legislation on contract management. So those are the key categories of areas that never get complied with when procurement activity is taking place. Now, we've also given you the top 10 contributors on the next slide, number 15. The top 10 contributors to this level of irregular expenditure as reported through the financial statements. Leading the pack among them, and you can see the amount, which is next to the name of that department. In this instance, the top one is Transport KZN, and followed by the rest of the other nine. But we've given some description as well as to the nature of this irregular expenditure. Maybe let me just use one example to illustrate some of these issues in the irregular expenditure environment that we audit, Chair. And I'm sure it will help shed some light as to whether indeed this is a loss or whether there may still be losses of one kind or another. So let's take an example with roads and transport Gauteng. They had a total of 2,087,000,000 of irregular expenditure this year. And I just like to read the narrative that's alongside roads and transport in Gauteng just to illustrate the point. So of the total irregular expenditure, 2,053.
Just a minute, AG. We just forgot, but let's switch off our cellular phones so that they don't disturb our meeting. Continue, AG.
Now, if you look at the roads and transport Gauteng, Chair, which is a 2 billion in total, if you round it off, that 2,087 is 2 billion of irregular expenditure. So you are saying here that 98% of that related to non-compliance in the bus subsidies contracting process. Due to the old legacy bus contracts, the department was not able to go out on tender, and the contracts were extended for 3 years until 31 March 2018. So what this means is that the basis for this irregular expenditure was deficiencies that were picked up at the contracting stage in terms of this bus contract. Now, this is a legacy bus contract, which means all payments that were made on this contract would have fallen foul of the definition of irregular expenditure, because you are paying on a deficient contract, and all of the payments that are made against that contract will be found to be irregular. And that's why we say that due to the old legacy contracts, the department was not able to go out on tender. So the department is not refreshing that tender. It continues to run the subsidy the way that it had concluded it. And then and the contracts were extended for 3 years until 31 March 2018. What it means is that in total, this contract has now come to an end at the end of March. The question is, it depends on how they conduct the next contract, whether they will continue to have irregular expenditure of this kind or not. So this is not recurring, as you can see. It's already final now because the contract ended on 31 March 2018. If the Department of Roads and Transport next year carries out a contracting process for buses, if it does it properly, it may not end up with any irregular expenditure come the following year. So some of these items of irregular expenditure, you can actually see that the bus subsidy system is still running, but the way that it was put in place was not in accordance with the prescribed regulations. However, the bus service still runs, and there's still a bus service, which means there's still a benefit being derived, even though it's happening on the back of a deficient contract. It will be similar to SASSA. SASSA was condoned as an illegal procurement process, but the people on the benefit side still receive their social grants, regardless of the fact that the instrument that brings it to them was found to be deficient. And it's a similar thing to this. Hence, we want to draw attention to the fact that there's some need for a deeper understanding of the underlying reasons for the irregular expenditure before we can conclude as to whether this money has gone down the tube or is it being flagged because of an originating deficiency at the level of contracting. Because the risk here also, as I try to spend a little bit more time on this, is that it tends to be washed with the same brush. And sometimes people suggest that all of this is what has gone into other people's pockets. But the reality here, if you take the example of Gauteng, there's a bus service. The people that for whom this subsidy was being made available still use that service, but that expenditure still flagged as irregular because of how they conducted the contracting at the beginning of that particular contract. And perhaps I'm just going to use that one example. The rest, Chair, I'm sure members can figure out as you read through the top 10 as to what are the major contentions associated with some of the items of irregular expenditure. Page 17. This is where the issue of the declining financial health and losses was coming from. Where, when we look at the numbers, Chair, and we really just look at the numbers based on what has been finalized in the respective income statements, the numbers as they are shown in the balance sheets, and really here we are just flagging the most prominent areas that indicate financial health risk. One of them is quite a number of the departments and entities we've audited have now started writing in red ink, in that the revenue is now exceeded by their costs. They've got deficits. Now, this normally indicates that the ability to generate money for ongoing activities is starting to decline because costs are ever increasing while the revenue or amount allocated is lower. 27% take longer than 90 days to collect debt. That's money due to them, but it takes forever, 90 days and longer, before the payments are made. However, 46% of these also took more than 30 days to pay their creditors as prescribed. And so these are all the elements, Chair, that we believe are predominantly what ought also to be under the watch of the accounting officer as per Section 38, 39, and 40. And you are seeing a significant and growing number of these financial health risks. And the reality is that when these financial health risks materialize for some of the entities, they may not be able to continue to provide the services and the things that they are set to provide. Hence, oversight over these regularly, quarterly if necessary, by the portfolio committees is also another point that we are flagging here, so that we don't discover after the financial year end that the department or entity no longer is able to pay for what is due. And we also highlighted also, Chair, here that in the next slide, number 18, when we look at the analysis also of the health and education department versus others. There were quite a number here as well within the health and the education portfolio. If one takes all the health departments across 9 provinces and the national one, same as health, and some of the areas of unfavorable indicators were quite evident, at least in the education as well as in the health. Mainly in the health department, I think the most vulnerable areas were largely in the health portfolios. To a lesser extent within the education department. So those key portfolios are also running the risk of not having sufficient resources to pay for their goods and services. We noted the departments which were particularly vulnerable, about 16 of them, and all of them are responsible in total for about 78.5 billion of the budget. Some of the financial indicators, Chair, as we split up, I'm not going to speak too much detail on this, on page 19 of the slides, that's where we show by province which ones of the health departments are showing a vulnerable position or not, and which ones of the health departments in each of the provinces are showing a vulnerability. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure, on page 20. We were down to below a billion up to 2016-2017, Chair, and it's now gone to about 2.5 billion in total of increase in fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And the major contributors, once more, which represent about 85% of the total, where the department has highlighted here, you can already see that a significant contributor to that level of fruitless and wasteful expenditure is the water trading entity, followed by defense, education, roads and transport, and so on. But the most significant part of it is within the water trading entity, because it accounts for just below 50% of the total, but all of the 10 have contributed 85% of the total in the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Unauthorized expenditure, these are instances also where overspending was identified in relation to the appropriated funds, and the highest contributors, once more, water and sanitation was one of them, followed by the rest of them on that page. I spoke earlier, Chair, to information technology controls, and I think I did make the point earlier at the beginning, but the slide that you have under 23 illustrates the trend over the years as to how the decline in the information technology control has been experienced in the audit. Financial health, as far as state-owned enterprises are concerned, we've assessed these based on some of the submissions that have been made. Notably, there were two among these, Petro SA and SABC. I think SABC, I also listened to SABC this morning talking about the SABC financial health. So it's clear, I think it's one of those entities that have struggled with cash management and have struggled, and I think the annual report and the financial statements that were presented to Parliament and spoken at the Communications Portfolio Committee yesterday is evidence of some of those things. But what was noted also in the SABC financial health status, Chair, was some efforts that were already being taken subsequent to the finalization of the report. So at least in a number of these state-owned entities, if one looks at the financial health, there's limited areas where there's vulnerability. Many of them have shown some good financial management disciplines. And in terms of the outstanding ones, which we have not been able to assess because of going concern challenges that they're experiencing currently, South African Airways Group is one of them. The Nexa Group, as you have seen, the Energy Group did not submit in terms of my outstanding audit slide. South African Express, the Denel Group, and the South African Post Office Group. Those are the entities that were still outstanding because they were trying to address some of their going concern issues. Irregular expenditure in supply chain, as far as the state-owned companies are concerned, at least it's starting to show a decline, a downward movement compared to last year. But these are some of the issues that need to be looked at also so that they don't grow over a period of time. I'm now on slide 26 under spending of grants departments. I think we were specifically requested also to identify areas where there are significant areas of grants allocated or rather underspent. So these are the provinces, Chair, in respect of the grants that we have indicated on the site. For example, the learner with profound intellectual disability grant, we found some areas of underspending, for example, in about four provinces, while the community library services grant underspending was largely only in the Northern Cape, while the others were fine as far as the spending on that grant. So there are still provinces, although not the majority, that still have experiences of underspending in respect of a number of grants that we are showing on this slide, which were underspent. And then spending on infrastructure grants by municipalities, I think was another specific request that we needed to flag the numbers. But the detail we didn't provide in this slide. We just provide the funding, the type of grant, as well as whether there was any underspending by more than 10% of that particular grant. So that's what slide 27 of 36 is showing. It's showing those areas of underspending as far as the municipal infrastructure grant is concerned, the urban settlement development grant, as well as the public transport network grant. So there's a couple of projects that we have looked at across a number of municipalities. The detail, as I say, of those municipalities and the extent of their underspending we can provide. Root causes of these financial deficiencies, Chair, once more. As is always the case, we often interact with the management and the senior management and accounting officers of the respective entities, together with those people that are exercising oversight over them, starting with executive authorities, the oversight bodies, and other internal control mechanisms to engage them on some of these things that we pick up in our audits. And our experience has been that the response, meaning the ability to act on the things that they have committed to do, we have found that it has been lacking the greatest part. However, in certain instances, it started to also mean that it's no longer just slow response. There are also elements of no response, because some of it has been recurring over a number of years, and we've just taken a view that it can't be so slow that it actually has been around for some 6 or 7 years. Some of it is definitely a no response, which means there's a disregard for either the implementation of the internal controls or there is no proper monitoring of these internal controls as they get to be implemented. And then, Chair, again, while we are busy trying to finalize matters around the amendments, as it were, of the Public Audit Act, we still have significant areas where there's no real consequence. So in the absence of consequences, a lot of these things carry on, and because nothing happens, even if they are pointed out in an audit. The audit environment, I guess, Chair, the point here that we are highlighting is that what you see in those outstanding audits, among others, is a combination of people not having been ready to finalize their accounts to the extent that they push back sometimes on the auditors, either because they want to avoid a bad audit outcome, or sometimes they were caught off guard and they didn't expect that they are going to regress from being previously clean to now suddenly facing a qualification. So the audit environment has become one of major contestations, I guess, as far as audit findings. And we do not shy away from those contestations, Chair, because they normally enrich the final outcome of an audit. But there are those outliers that are contesting the audit because they don't like it, not because they've got other evidence to support their assertions. The bottom line is that they just contest it because they don't like it. So so we kind of think that it's important for you to also appreciate the fact that not everything that's outstanding is looking for a document that's possibly hidden somewhere. Sometimes it's just that people can't live with the fact that 1 plus 1 is 2. sometimes want it to be a different answer. On page 30, Chair, just a quick rundown of the things that we have put in place on our side to try and assist in effecting the improvement in these audit outcomes. I think a lot of this will be familiar to you, but I think what's important is perhaps on the next page. We've introduced a status of records review process, Chair, and the objective of this, as you will see on the slide number 31, is to reach out, as it were, to the accounting officers, cognizant of their responsibilities as set out in Section 38, 39, and 40 of the PFMA. We come forth to them to say, what are your concerns as the accounting officer, including the CFO, that you already know, that you believe may derail the progress in the preparation of financial and performance reports? So we have this discussion with them before the end of the financial year so that we can, together with them and their internal auditors, get to the accounts that never get reconciled frequently, get to the balancing processes and the procedures to close the books at regular intervals that they never get around to. To remind them also that when they've got ongoing capital projects which may go beyond one financial year, to what extent have they put in monitoring processes to make sure that the money that gets booked in the debits in the books is representative of progress being made on the physical projects that are being delivered. So this status of records review is about giving them a heads up prior to year end, but alerting them to the fact that better be aware of the things that can cause you audit failure upfront, so that as an accounting officer you can do your best to manage it. We have had a very positive feedback and response from many of the accounting officers embracing this, because it alerted them to areas that in the past they were not able to look at. So we're still on a journey to implement this. Up to now, as at the end of March this year, we've done it at about 59% of the audits. And really, it's just a heads up to say, you know, last year your audit was a qualification. You know the reason for that qualification. What have you done about it, at least in the first two or three quarters of this year? Because if you've done nothing about it, then the chances are that your audit outcome is possibly going to be exactly the same, if not worse, than the previous year. So that is the effort on our part as far as at least the mid-term intervention is concerned, Chair. And then we just thought that as we present these audit outcomes, Chair, I also picked it up in some of the news medias that the AG must now do something about these things now because they've got the powers. Well, the process of getting to finality, I guess, is what we are at now. So we don't want to get into a situation where we now are in trouble in the public domain when we present these outcomes, because people think we now have powers to do something about this. And that's why I wanted to explain the fundamentals around those powers as well. They are about creating sufficient pressure to trigger the actions that are contained in those sections that I referred to. And once they are in place, I think they will assist a great deal. Because now it's no longer going to be a case of, I'll deal with this thing next year. Those powers provide for the recommendations to be made in your financials and in your management report now as an accounting officer. And it will call on you to go and act on those things that are in Section 38, 39, and 40. That's predominantly what it's going to say, because there's nothing outside of those provisions that we will speak about. We will speak about those things that are in those sections. And if no action is taken within a reasonable space of time when the report is presented, that's when the Section 5B, as proposed, of the amendments will kick in, which means someone will now know that we are starting to encroach very closely to their pocket, in essence, by activating something that will make them think carefully about how to prevent irregular, unauthorized, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, how to make sure that the resources of the department are managed efficiently, economically, and effectively. However, our role will continue to be to report, in essence. I think that's the bottom line. We'll continue to be there to report on who have responded to their recommendations and how have they responded to their recommendations. And those are the kind of reports that we will provide also to committees like SCOPA in the future, where we articulate the specific actions based on the recommendations made that had been taken. So in essence, Chair, then as we perhaps get closer to ending the presentation, we think that the proposed amendments really are about, they're not about discouraging creativity, they are about encouraging accountability. So people can still be creative and do things in the best possible way they think it will achieve their results, but at the center of it, accountability and good governance still remains the core, because without those, then those functions that are set in Section 38 onwards may not have much relevance. But the beauty about this, Chair, is that up to now, we have not really spoken about material irregularities. Now, on page 34 of this slide, the second last one, we are also highlighting what that particular material irregularity is about. In the past, we would report things as they are deficiencies from existing legislation. But the definition of a material irregularity in terms of what is in our proposed amendment deals with quite a wide range of issues that may be part of our reports come the future when we activate the proposed amendments. But the biggest issue here is that it's got to be something that is irregular and it must be material. And therefore, there will be quite a huge navigation activity that the auditors are going to have to do when they go through their normal statutory audit to look for those areas of non-compliance where there's been contravention of legislation, where there's suspected fraud, or where there's a breach of a fiduciary duty by somebody who may be an accounting authority. Accounting authorities, by the way, are also included in those sections that I referred to. So when we start looking at consequences in respect of this as they arise in the Public Audit Act Amendment, they are predominantly focused on those sections, specifically around accounting officer and accounting authority. So that's one of the things I think that will be preoccupying us, Chair, because we would now be looking at a situation where we've actually tried to quantify the amounts involved. Has there been a material financial loss as a result of that material irregularity? Those are the things that we're going to be going through clarifying on our side when we finalize the reports. And then lastly, the key areas of this mandate, just as a reminder, Chair, is firstly, the referral part of it, which is about finding another body that has got the competency and the capacity to carry out the detail to get to the bottom of some of the deficiencies, the ability to have remedial action in the event that there's been a failure to implement a recommendation on the audit, and lastly, the power to issue a certificate of debt for those that may not have implemented the recommendations if there was a financial loss that is involved after an investigation has been carried out. So those are some of the things, Chair, that are in the pipeline, at least for us at the moment, but I think they bear direct relevance to these audit outcomes, because I'm sure there will be questions that come our way to say, now, why don't you do something about these things yourself? And I think the idea was for us to be an instrument to assist oversight to even do better in terms of their own rules. So let me leave it at that, Chair, and that's the long and short of our PFMA audit cycle for the 2017-2018 year. As I said, we currently canvassing engagements with all the provinces now, and the planned date for the launch of this report will be the 23rd of November. Thank you.
Thank you very much, AJ. Comrades, can I propose that we have a 2 minutes break so we can grab some tea, and then we can come back and then engage with AJ. Well, everybody is invited. Alright, comrades, we have heard the presentation by the Auditor General. Any questions of clarity? Can be questions of substance. Those will ask the department, not the Auditor General. Please. So, alright, let me see. Alright. I'll start here in the Free State. Oh, okay, let me just go right round and then come. So, yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you all, AG, for the very good presentation. Of course, we would like to box from the same corner, but just in terms of clarity with regards to the closing balances of irregular expenditure, you've indicated that we have a 50 billion rand of irregular expenditure in the current financial year. We've also done some analysis in this regard, and whilst our documents refers to the closing balances, we are of the opinion that we have a irregular expenditure of about 72.6 billion rand of irregular expenditure. Now, we would just like a clarification with regards to where perhaps the differential comes in terms of the figures. We are of the opinion that we work on the closing balances, which is also the amounts brought forward, if you can perhaps give us some clarity with regard to that. And if it is the also the accumulated amounts or the amounts from previous years, your recommendations in terms of addressing it. I know it's an obligation of Parliament to either condone or reject it, but also perhaps other issues that you would think we can address these closing balances to find common consensus on this. And then also it appears that that you might have used the audit cutoff date on the 31st of August. Now, we went to the stores and we did some investigation in terms of the annual reports. And in the annual reports of the 30th of September, it was an indicator that we are of the opinion that regular expenditure is a whopping 72 billion.
Honourable Member, just go by line then go to take the answer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, AG. I just want to take a slightly different tack for a change. The numbers and the presentation overall say to me that things are not getting better. Much as you try as hard as you can to produce the reports, do the audits, produce the outcomes, is it your experience that you're getting more and more resistance from those you audit to provide you with the information you need? Because the bottom line for me is, although it's a numbers problem, ultimately, the numbers problem is caused by the people. And therefore, it's actually a people problem, this. It's those who are the accounting officers, are the responsible persons, are just not accepting the responsibility. They may not be qualified to accept the responsibility, and they may just not have the will to do it. But is that your experience? Because that seems to be, from my perspective, what I'm seeing here, and I just want to know what your take would be on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I take it we're just going to ask our questions and then get a response. Will we have a follow-up round if necessary? If necessary, okay. All right. the issues I'd like to address are as follows. As my colleague to my left, Chair Honourable McLaughlin, has pointed out, it doesn't seem to be getting better, and I'm sure it is a great frustration to you, being the professional that you are. The issue is that some few years ago, the office of the Chief Procurement Officer was opened in Treasury. And that was, at the time, kind of sold as by Treasury as a bit of a silver bullet, that this office would coordinate supply chain management, that we would, I think it was Mr. Human who gave us a presentation so long ago saying that if we purchased in bulk, we should get better prices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the question that, my first question is the office of the Chief Procurement Officer, in your opinion, actually working? Is it actually working? Is it playing any particular role? And are Treasury playing their role in bringing departments to where they should be? Or are they just being ignored as well? The second question then is the nationalization of supply chain management, these are important questions, is that actually working? Or do we need to look again at decentralizing SCM and beefing up the protocols to control it and management at lower level? Simply because I have contractors who get hold of me who tell me that they issued tender documents or handed in tender documents 3 years ago and are getting contacted yesterday. They told me to bring this to your attention because they knew I was coming here. Yesterday saying, can you extend the validity of your tender documents? 3 years later. So are we not just overburdening Pretoria, and can it actually operate? So those are the first two issues. The other issue then is the debt certificate, which we are all hoping will be, you know, a great silver bullet. We're hoping. We're hopeful. Okay. So the question is now, in your presentation on page 31, and 34, on page 31 we refer to the process that it's going through, this page here, and you know, I think one of the things that we hate in SCOPA is words like in progress, because it's how long is a piece of string, you know, when we see disciplinary in progress, we hate that sort of thing. So can you please comment on that in progress, so the drafting of secondary legislation, the enabling legislation, which enables you to get involved in the practical tools. Where are we in that process? After the amendment was agreed to, where are we in that process, and how long do you anticipate it's going to take for that to get sorted out? And then we're still waiting for the President's assent. Is that on the amendment? Because the President can't assent to new legislation yet because it hasn't been formalized yet. So the question is, do you have any insight as to why we're still waiting for the President's assent? And what is general, the reason I'm asking these questions is it's all well and good to amend the Act to give you this fantastic tool of remedial action. But if the legislators slow it down, there's clearly another agenda at play. And so we, as the oversight body on public accounts, have got to say, is that going to be happening? When do you see the actual rollout of the debt certificate? Could it be another year, 2 years, 3 years? Because from where I'm sitting is, if you had it now, you would only be able to start using it next year this time, am I right? When you start finishing up all the audits and then... And then you would issue the warning saying, right, listen, you need to get this done. And then only, I don't know,
right.
3 months later or 6 months later, gee, I know, but these are important issues.
That depends on the President signing. You can't answer when the
President... No, I know you... Okay, I'm not going to interrupt you, so please.
I'm just saying, don't belabor the point.
I'm not belaboring the point, Chair. I'm trying to say that I'm very, very concerned, and I'd like to get the AG's opinion, that this is a process that could only happen in 2, 3, 4, 5 years' time because legislators are deliberately slowing it down. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Chair.
So, our comrade Imam, then comrade Foy.
Thank you, Chair, and the co-chairs, and I'd like to take this opportunity first to thank the Office of the AG for giving us the status of our financial performance of the 2017-2018. Actually, it's for the 4 years. And my questions are just about four. The first one is, looking at the example that has been given by the AG on the Gauteng regarding irregular expenditure, and it gives us that example of the bus tender. Is it possible that we might have some similar situations, taking for an example, where an investigation has been taken into consideration, or it has been, you know, issued that this tender has to be investigated maybe in 2011 or 2012, and then the audit outcome of that incident then gets reflected to the present audit outcome of 2017-2018. If that's the case, then is it a similar behavior that, so this means that once that gets sorted out, once that investigation has been carried out and that audit outcome has been given, it means we're not supposed to see this behavior. And then two, Chairperson, the AG has indicated to us that he is going to take some engagement with the provinces regarding what the report that is sitting in front of us. The question is the AG going to engage at what level? To the personnel that are at the assurance level or sphere of government, or where? Because for me, it is very much important that you also involve the people that are conducting the internal controls of departments together with whatever the AG is going to choose to meet with. So if I can get the clarity there. And then the last one, out of the number that the AG has given us, the national part, is it possible that maybe you can just give us the guidelines as to this, maybe with the departments there were so many and the entities nationally were so many, I didn't see it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for that presentation. I must admit that it was expected that we are going to come here and find the report as damning as we have here. But my first question is going to be, given the fact that the Public Audit Amendment Act is going to be now amended to give you more powers, I'd like to know what process you're now going to follow in terms of reporting to us, because I think the confusion still exists. Why is it giving you more powers? The question I'm asking is, how would you report to us right down to the level, and I think my colleague has also covered it to a certain extent, in terms of getting to the root of the problem, whether it's identifying particular people that are repeat offenders? Because my understanding is still that all you're going to do is make recommendations. We need to have the will to act on those recommendations in any event. And that's where we seem to be failing. And you correctly said earlier on that, you know, it's not any new stuff. It's more just trying to strengthen it. So if you're going to tell us to what extent you will go in reporting to us so that we together could fight this war that is going on to be able to ensure that we improve the performance on the ground. That's the first question. The second one is, I want to know, and this is through my observation, sir, with due respect, no matter how good your auditing system, and I've been told we have some of the best systems in the world, and I don't doubt it, my understanding is still, if you know how to manipulate your books, you will still get unqualified audit. You will still be able to deceive, if I cannot use the word, the Auditor General, because basically it's the information that is provided. Do you have any mechanisms to be able to identify that, where you would find that some of us might be very good and might be able to manipulate the system, and for that reason you would find that we will get unqualified audits and things? The other thing is this, and very importantly, whilst we're dealing with these audits, there's a major problem in terms of where South Africa loses approximately, and I think your previous CEO, somebody from supply chain, said that, 40% in supply chain of goods and services, which have lost 600 billion, now it's more, which is about 200 billion rand or more now, is being lost through tender processes and things, because you're not getting value for money all over the country because of the processes that we put. In other words, you will buy an item in Durban for 10 rand and you will pay 100 rand in Gauteng, same item. And we're losing, the estimated value is about 200 billion rand. I think now it's gone. What mechanisms will you put in place to ensure that we deal with that on the ground as well? Now, the last one, Chair, if it's okay with you. And I'm quite certain this might be happening. When you have audit findings which are negative on some of the entities or whatever it is, you may find some of us coming and putting up a fight with you. No, we're not accepting this, not accepting, can you change it, what is going on? How often does this happen, and how often do you change that audit opinion to either suit us, or because you threatened, or whatever it is, because I've been hearing the audit has been threatened throughout the country. Has that happened? How often does it happen? And to what extent is it happening? And are you able to deal with it? Thank you, sir.
Comrade Boy. And then after Comrade Boy, maybe AG, you can respond, and then we can
So, thank you, AG, for your good report. But I do have concerns. If you go to page 30, what do you call that? Is it a new methodology that you're using in engaging DGs? To look at your last paragraph there, Director Generals and whatnot. How long have you been using that type of system of talking to Director Generals? And how does that work? You have a meeting, you call them, you advise them, at which stage of the auditing does that take place? Because if you deal with the 41 request, it means that there's been an increase of people who've been doing what is wrong within departments. How do you put that story into that page 30 on reflection? What happened here? Because I mean, after you've read the report on how inconsistent government has been in changing Director Generals. Which Director Generals are you talking to or are you talking about at this level that are so consistent in helping to improve the auditing work that you're doing? I'm just substantially not being able to relate to what I know, because I'm in the Public Administration Committee, to the nature of Director Generals that we have. And now with you, the first one has been saying some of them, they have realized that they were late in submissions or they were not on time, and they say if they take the information back and want to be able to deal with it. Which Director Generals are you reflecting on? And how, I know there's a first step where all Director Generals are meeting. Are you participant to that, or where are you that you are talking to these different people? Or who is dealing with these Directors Generals? Just give us a substantial sense for us to be comfortable that your methodology here on page 30 is not reflective of the regress that is taking place within what we have seen in the past.
Okay. Thank you very much, AG.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to start with perhaps the part that Honorable Boy raised. May I ask, Chair, as far as the Office of the Procurement Office is concerned, if that's fine with the Honorable Member. I saw the Acting Accountant General here, who I'm sure could assist in that one, because I'll be reticent to talk about the options or the choices that need to be made, because it's another institution. They can best describe how they could potentially handle that. I can talk from a different angle as far as our experience of interaction is concerned. But if it's fine, Chair, maybe the Accountant General can assist with that part of the Office of the Procurement Office. Let me start with the engagement with the DGs. We started these outcomes, we started engaging them last week at FOSAT, where all the directors general from national departments to provinces were present, convened by the DG in the presidency. And that's an annual routine. Every year when we finalize these audit outcomes, we engage with them. We share with them some of the issues that we picked up, and we have a discussion with them on some of the things they will do. Or sometimes they'll have a discussion after we've presented among themselves as well. So, you know, they do have that access to this as a group, all of them, in one meeting. So we've already done that with them. They were the first to get a bite of these audit outcomes, the whole forum of South African DGs. So they are appraised of these issues. They are appraised of the common threads and the common elements that we normally find in these audits. It's not like a case of this DG knows only about their portfolio, but they also have got a good idea about the key trends, the key issues that are of concern to us in the audit. So we're more than happy with that part, Honorable Boy, that there is engagement appropriately. But on top of that, because they are responsible as accounting officers for various things, the final clearance of any of the audits in their portfolios is with them first, because they've got the accountability to report to their executive authorities as well on these matters. So there's that level of interaction at a lower level directly in their portfolios, but also the overarching one as a group. So we've always enjoyed this level of engagement over the years with them. And there in that meeting, the kind of conversation we have is not one that instructs you, thou shall. We normally just share with them and highlight to them some of the more risky areas that they individually may not have appreciated if they were looking at their only portfolios. So it's partly adding value in the sense that we have never had a shortage of these engagements, let alone actions following on it. As far as the methodology of the status of records review, this idea of a status of records review, Honorable Nyam, is the discipline that has been there in financial management predominantly over the years, but you never really heard it in the public sector. Private sector institutions, as you know, some of them are listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Every year or half year, they need to present their results also on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Part of the things they do, for example, is a status of records review in an institution, because what it says is that it brings to the attention of the decision makers some of the issues that could result in significant systemic failure in managing the ongoing activities of a particular enterprise. Let's take an example of where this status of records review is helpful. There was a time some years ago we went to one municipality in the Eastern Cape, and they were presenting their outcomes and their financial statements to us as auditors for purposes of the audit. So they have drafted the financial statements, and because they never done the reconciliations of their accounts, all they did was to pluck the figures from the trial balance and put them on a spreadsheet, summarize it, and report those numbers. So one of the numbers that was in the books was some balance of about 65 million rands in a municipality. and they had shown it as a sundry debtor. Now, that is an amount owing by somebody to them. They are claiming in their books that there is 65 million rands that somebody owes us as a municipality. So when we see this, we kind of say, but there was no such amount of such significance last year. Where is this 65 million all of a sudden coming from? And then they scratched around, only to realize after we dig deeper, because the status of records review is asking you as the person who prepares the books to show the books, not to show the summary of the financial statements. Show the books as they are, where you punched on the keyboard and you entered figures, they pop up at the back in the accounting record. So you want to see that record because that's the original form of entry into the books. Only to find out this 65 million rands was what is called a sundry miscellaneous account. Now miscellaneous, by definition, is a combination of all sorts of things that can go to that account. Now they didn't do a proper reconciliation of this account to know exactly what this 65 million. It's only after we pushed back in the audit through the form of a status of records review that we realized the genuine balance that could be classified as a debtor was somewhere around 500,000. The 60-odd million was an accumulation of transactions, including the likes of if in this municipality you had to buy fencing. That department that's responsible for infrastructure will throw the debit into this account. But there is no accountant who scrutinizes this account during the course of the year to check whether that 1.2 million rands for fencing was a genuinely fence delivered. Does the head of infrastructure in the municipality know about it? Is the price in accordance with the award in the supply chain management process? And all sorts of things. Now everybody uses this and then it becomes a dumping ground. Now a dumping ground of that nature, unfortunately,
yeah, I don't want us to belabor the point because we have a whole series of questions.
Okay. But the bottom line is that this is useful to help the accounting officer understand what's going on in their books. Because sometimes they look at one number and they don't know where it's coming from and what it's made up. So it's a form of internal control, the status of records review. It's not a new methodology, it's an enhanced internal control. How often are there contestations in an audit? Contestations in an audit are often present because people make promises that they will fix that weakness in the internal control environment and they never do it. And then they get caught out in the audit on the same matter that was reported in the previous year. And then now they try and contest it. Says, no, your interpretation of this thing is not the same as my interpretation. And that's what the toing and froing is about mostly. So people contest them because they've got the right. Remember, the other issue with the audit is that the representations that are made in financial statements belong to management. What belongs to the auditor is the opinion on those financial statements. So if management still wants to change certain things in the financial statements, it's within their right to want to change it because it is the representations that they make. All we do is to report on their representations. So when they contest it, sometimes they are contesting it to tell a different story, but then the different story they tell must also be audited to check if it is indeed the true story. And most of the time, depending on what has surfaced afterwards, if there was evidence that was not made available to the auditors initially, and subsequently they make available new evidence, it may change the original opinion of the auditor. It all depends on what has the client resubmitted. So we are not going to be rigid about the original opinion, even if there is subsequent evidence that is submitted. But the opinion will not change just because of desire by the auditee. If the auditee desires a different audit opinion without substance, then the audit opinion does not change. And we've got protective measures here in terms of this because our standards prescribe that the proposed audit opinion is an opinion that is proposed by the team that did that audit. Somebody comes to me and they complain about the audit team, how they executed their audit. I often go back to the audit team because they are the people on the coal face who see the books. It must be them who propose a change, not someone else. Because if it's someone else, then the integrity of the process will be compromised. So it's always back to the audit team because they are the ones who from very early on in the audit saw the planning right up to the execution, up to evaluating the entire audit evidence. And we say that we respect the fact that all of them in their own right collectively are professionals and they know how to apply their judgment to what they've seen in the audit. So there is no persuading the auditing, the auditors without due cause to change opinions. Economical procurement through the Office of the Procurement Officer. Chair, this one, and that's why I thought Ms. Mkunyelo can help here. There's a lot of initiatives that were put in place when this office was started, the Procurement Office in the National Treasury. And perhaps I'm sure they can assist us in taking us through where they are now. But some of the examples, for example, were in the education sector, one of the things they piloted a few years ago was to do bulk buying for the likes of learning materials because they are distributed across the country in different schools. And they experimented with those things, experimented with prices pertaining to those things, but also in areas like telecoms, if you recall at some point a few years ago, where they were starting to negotiate as a public sector for some of those dominant services that are used, even in communication and all of that. I do not know much of the detail of that, and that's why I thought perhaps National Treasury can assist us there. the reporting process after the PAA amendments, how are we going to do this? Chair, we've already taken steps after the whole process was put through Parliament in May and June, and we continued the work in the audit, in the audit office to unpack some of these matters that will be important to answer the how now, because I think for the greatest part we were dealing with the what, and now the how has become a pertinent part of our process. I must say that that is still in progress, but it has progressed to the point where we've already had a national gathering of the office with all of the 9 provinces, senior managers and above, to reflect on these matters ourselves in the audit office so that we can socialize them across the office. It must not be known to 5 of us in the executive team. It must be something that is owned and known to the people who are going to be going to do these audits, whether in Northwest, in the Free State, or in Western Cape, or anywhere. So we had a gathering that was a gathering of about close to 300 senior managers across the office, across the board, to interrogate these amendments as well as the regulations that we had started developing. So we've got set of regulations that we are waiting to engage our standing committee on the AG because they are the primary custodian of that process. So we've already got a date, and that will be happening in the month of October still, if I'm right. Yes, we've got a scheduled date to engage with these regulations because that's what was required. How are you going to do this? So we've got that packaged already, and we are waiting for that meeting to reflect on it. So the how are you going to do this will be clearly set out in that meeting. Then there's an issue around the limitations. Well, I just wrote it as limitations of an audit, and how do we go about uncovering things that are hidden from us to the point where we end up with an unqualified opinion. I think that was the point. Chair, there is one thing in an audit that, however experienced an auditor is, that they cannot prevent. And that is if there is collusion in the institution that you are auditing, and the people that are providing you the evidence, who are making the assertions, are also prepared to collude among themselves and say something was for a particular amount and they both agree on that amount. You as an outsider coming in as an auditor, you probably are none the wiser once there is high levels of collusion. So that is one limitation, unfortunately, of this process. But secondly, those same senior people, if it is upon them to override some of the controls, they can override the controls and make it look like this environment is still managed according to the controls, but in the meantime they override them and restore them afterwards in order to effect certain transactions. That is also possible. However, an auditor is only required in these instances to remain a lot more skeptical, because you don't just go straight to the books. We do other things that give us a sense as to where the bulk of the transactions and the debits and the credits ought to have gone. But the difficulty that an auditor will always have is to put their hand in the heart and say, I have dealt with all the completeness risks, because you will never know what you do not know for as long as it never surfaced. But you can try. If someone says they are producing diamonds, you expect some revenue from those diamonds, but you also expect some inventory to be somewhere in this environment. And therefore, there are other things that we do to try and work backwards to get to what the real answer should be. Sometimes that's what gets us into a fight, because we try to reconstruct what the balance could be, taking into account the things that have happened, and they may have a different leader. And so those are the issues, I think, that one cannot avoid. But our view is, if an audit has come to a conclusion on a particular matter, the contestation is allowed for as long as it makes sense to deal with that matter. But as I say, there are limitations here, Chair. It's not an exact science that you know, even if they colluded, you will find it. Sometimes you won't. I think you had a similar situation here in Parliament recently where there were executives that visited Parliament to speak about their business. So you saw some elements of what I'm saying there. Engagement with provinces. We engage provinces at the level of the executive in the provinces as well as the legislatures. So when we go around to do the roadshow in the provinces, our target is to meet with Premier and team together with the Speaker and team in the legislature, because they both play a role of overseeing the activities. Some of them preside over the implementation of those activities. So our provincial engagements are largely the effort to inform Premier and executives in all of them. And then the death certificate and the drafting of this secondary legislation, that's what I referred to in terms of the regulations. We are almost there. Whatever will arise from our meeting with SCOWEC will determine how much longer we need to do anything, if anything, after that process. I think, Honourable Member, you'll appreciate the fact that the matter, once it has left Parliament, after Parliament has processed it, it's normally Parliament that sends it straight to the President. Our involvement is normally to find out from our committee in Parliament how far are things. So we never go to the Presidency to find out, otherwise we might regret it. Right. Let's talk about the one first part that was raised regarding the irregular expenditure. I think the point I need to make here, as far as the comparison between the 50 and the 72 is concerned, is that let's trust the audit process, because the audit process has shown itself over the years to be authentic and credible. So I think let's try and do that. Otherwise, if we throw around different numbers, we are going to confuse the public. The audit process has always been a reliable source of all the deficiencies in respect of matters of irregular expenditure. And the beauty about it, as well as the advantage of the audit process, is that it normally has unlimited access to the verifiable evidence that is required, and that is a constitutionally protected right. Anybody else other than an auditor might bring a combination of speculation and fact. It's possible. Doesn't matter who that person is, as long as they don't have the statutory license to do an audit, they may just surface speculation and fact. And then nobody will know now what number is the right number. But let's just say that, let's just take it from history, that the number arising from an audit process is the most reliable and is the one that must be taken, as it were, because there are hundreds of people who interrogate these numbers every day across the country, in all of these 434 people, and that effort produces that number. Right. Now, as far as the things not getting better, and what's my take as far as these issues are concerned? I think the issue here is that the discipline to action recommendations is a discipline that gets cultivated in an environment where you also have stability of leadership in an organization. If somebody has been given charge in a department to look after its affairs for 6 months and they are gone, and then somebody else comes for another 18 months, and you've got that whole process of people staying in and going out and not being there, firmly developing these disciplines. Sometimes the rest of the people left in the organization see a gap because they know that the ones who are administering these accounts this year, two of them are no longer there, and they will run rings around them, especially if they can see there's a gap in the internal control environment. And that's why we believe that a lot of these issues, that the reason they're not getting better is because there's a lot of instability. People try different experiments as they go along and never pay attention to the fact that for an internal control to be sustainably in place, it requires to be supervised and put in place over a period of time. Otherwise, it goes wobbly and nobody knows how we lost track of the implementation of a program, for example. Hence, you find in some programs there's doubling up of budgets because that supervision and that rigor to keep at it is sometimes lost before we know it. Chair, I think I'm left now with the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer issues that were raised. Right. Perhaps we can take guidance from you.
No, that's fine. I want to check other comrades. No. I want to check those who haven't spoken. If there's anyone who wants to make a contribution. Yeah, I'll start with you, comrades. You'll get the opportunity. You'll get the opportunity. Don't worry. You'll get it. Yes, comrade.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Just something that's already been really addressed, but I wanted just to comment on the issue of these contestations, which seem to be really increasing over there. Because even in the last financial year, you could see that people are just contesting for the sake, like you were saying, for the sake of contesting, that it's an area of serious concern. But my question is, I know that the office of the AG is accessible to the government departments. How often, or do they really utilize this opportunity of engaging with the office of the AG in between the audits? Because looks like there's these things just surface when it's already the auditing period, and in between, I would expect that people would then utilize the office of the AG to address issues instead of the same issues keeping on coming up all the time. Because this is the only way that we can actually improve issues of governance, issues of accountability, which is expected. Because we have people who've been in the department for a long time, but they just continue as if this level of non-compliance is just unacceptable. It's more of a commentary. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, comrade.
Yes, Chairperson, just one clarity and a comment. On slide 18, that green bar on the right bottom, I see that you're saying 67% of the health departments are facing claims exceeding 100% of their budgets. If you could explain that in relation to what exactly as you say, does it include accruals as well? And what are the implications, therefore, for the next financial year budget? Chair, I want to comment about this thing about the 50 billion and the 72 billion. I find it rather strange that our colleagues sat among themselves a couple of weeks ago, picked up some figures, called a press conference, caused confusion among the people in the just generally on issues of the audit, and only now they come to ask the Auditor General to verify whether they are correct or not. I would have imagined that they would have consulted with the office of the Auditor General if they thought they were seeing figures that are beyond what the auditor, the outcome of the audit, had exposed, and that cast aspersions on the credibility of the office itself and the personnel, the skilled personnel that works there. That's very regrettable. Thank you, Chair.
Comrade Kuno.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation, AG. PFMA and maybe Treasury regulations, or most of the regulations that we're dealing with when we're dealing with finances and auditing, concentrates more on the high level or the accounting officers. But I think one thing, Chairperson, that we are all ignoring as legislators, as accountants and everybody else, is the middle management. And to me, that's where the real power is. Because those are the people who can actually say, this will go and this won't go. And that's where you find a lot of disputes and problems, and they play as they please, and they know that it's difficult for anyone to find them. And I know that when you audit, you send your team, and we were told so many times that they would spend 6 months or so within a department to tackle or deal with all the issues that are there. And obviously when there are red alerts, you alert them to actually say, this is the problem, what are you doing to deal with that problem, so that at the end of the day, we get the audit outcome that we all want to see. My question is that, Chairperson, how do you, because I know that even in the amendments, we have not dealt with that at all. And to me, if we do not, because that's where supply chain, that's where the serious problems are. Or if we could talk about corruption, those are the people who don't even want to be vetted because they do as they please. They play around with prices. I think 2 years ago we had the chief procurement officer who even told us how they play around with prices. That's why you cannot find stable prices. And when it comes to government, prices are always inflated. So I'm just saying that we need to find an effort, because much as we are trying to make sure that the accounting officers do as they're supposed to be doing, we're trying to have a perfect situation, but in an imperfect situation, which is which becomes very difficult to really control. I'm actually saying, what are we doing to make sure that they also come into the part as well? And at the end of the day, whoever has done anything wrong or who has transgressed any laws has to be dealt with, because we normally look at that, but the real people who are doing this thing, they get away with it, because some of the mistakes are real mistakes. They are not mistakes because I wanted to charge some money, but they are mistakes because it was, you know, an oversight I didn't see, because I expect somebody who brought that document to me to sign to have looked at into that. So I'm just saying, I just need your comment on that. Thanks. Oh, and Chairperson, the last thing, sorry, I wanted to deal with is that year in, year after, we have departments that don't want to report on time. I know, the only department that came into my mind now is Environmental Affairs. I'm sorry to make an example about that because we've just lost the minister. But I'm just saying we have to find a way of dealing with all these departments that don't report on time. Because if they don't report on time, it means if there's a serious problem. We need to be an accountable government. And if we're taking accountability and oversight seriously, that's where we need to start. And I think we really need to address that as soon as possible. Thanks, Chair.
Well, thank you so much, AG, for the insightful presentation. Actually, one of the questions I wanted to rise on is the last question raised by my colleague on the outstanding audits. I just want to check with you, Auditor General, on what is your recourse? I understand that there's amendments that will give you more teeth, but for now, because to me, what is important when we engage like this is to find solutions. And those solutions, we will then, as these committees, we can then formulate recommendations based on those solutions. But with all of us sitting here, I think we can come up with concrete possible solutions. Because it's not good enough to talk about these things, and there is no corrective measure after talking about them. Okay, and I'm talking, and I know that once those solutions are translated into recommendations that are adopted by the House, in my thinking, they will be more binding for implementation. So I think that's one question I wanted to ask. But also maybe to try and address this, what are the possibilities of Auditor General carrying out the audits on a 6-monthly basis? Because I know it might be costly, but I think it's a necessary exercise. What you are doing, you want to prevent a situation where come end of the financial year, you don't have information. 6-monthly basis, if you can look into that one. Again, I know that the National Treasury has promised to send out instructions to departments to deal with 30 days non-payment by departments, to service providers by departments. To the extent that this 30 days non-payment kills small businesses, job creation and economic growth, what advice can you give? Also, my angle is to find a solution. What advice can you give on having something that can turn the situation around? Because this has been going on and on and on. And upon reflection, we always get a response that says the service providers don't submit invoices. But honestly speaking, Auditor General, which service provider would not want to be paid? You can see that you ask yourself, but which service provider, after you have worked and knowing that you will only be paid when you've submitted your invoice? So there's that. That's one part that I don't understand, and I'm failing to understand. But then, what advice or what possible solutions can you give, which we can use also as a recommendation, hoping that it will be a binding recommendation once it's passed by the House? I think I would like to stop there. Thank you.
All right. Comrade at the back, Comrade Boy, protested. And then not chubby. Yes, yes, comrade.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me also welcome the presentation by the EG. I have a concern with regards to the IDT, precisely because in most of the cases it's dealing with infrastructure. And now, if it's having a disclaimer in four successive financial years, it indicates that's a serious problem. As Appropriations Committee, we met with the Department of Defense, Public Works, Health, and they were claiming one another precisely because the infrastructure that we saw when we made our oversight visit were not satisfactory to ourselves.
No, just a minute. I think the journalist lady cannot be tolerable. Yes, continue.
So, Chairperson, I think there is an agency as the Committee of Appropriation that we need to meet with the IDT, precisely because these departments are complaining that as of now, towards the adjustment appropriation that is coming, some of the monies are going to be withdrawn precisely because of the failure of the IDT. That's one concern that I have. The second issue is the issue that was raised by my colleague with the migrant management. Indeed, in most of the cases, the people who are counting are the senior management, but most of the corruption is happening at the middle level, and their lifestyle is very different from other people. Thank you very much.
Hey, Comrade Boy. You're fine. Imam, okay. No, you'll...
Thank you, Chair. There are two things that I want to ask, and I promise you, AG, the one that I'm going to ask is not going to cost you your job. I promise you that one. Now, one thing we all know and we're accepting, the problems are persistent. It's going on from year to year to year. There's no change. It's getting worse, in fact, we can see. I want you to be honest and tell us in what you, whether you've identified or established through all the weaknesses thus far, do you believe that one of the problems could be that there's really no, in practice, and I'm not talking on paper, there's no difference, because what I find is happening, unless you separate administration from politics, the problem is going to persist and it's going to continue. And as a result of that, you sometimes lack capacity, you have problems, on all the different entities and structures. So I want you to tell me whether you've observed this in any other way, that there's no capacity, it's because we put in people because we like them. And this is across the board with all political parties, every one of them. There's no exception. That's the first thing. The second thing is I want you to tell me, sir, in your understanding thus far, and I know that the committee, the AG's committee is going to be meeting soon, in your understanding thus far, in terms of those amendments, if you could just run us through, in your understanding, thus far, with those amendments, what is the actual process, or what is expected of you? In other words, you will identify, you will establish, you will report. Thus far, what is your understanding of where your powers lie and ends? Because remember, the onus is still on somebody else to act on your recommendations and all. So I just wanted some clarity on what your understanding is thus far on your powers in terms of those amendments. Thank you.
We can do it either way. You can start and she'll follow. Sure. All right.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. The reason why I wanted him to start is I wanted my chairperson to be here.
Chair, I'll be very quick. My question just to the AG, and I forgot to ask it earlier. AG, last year we had very disturbing reports about actual, we understand contestation, you've covered that, but actual threats. And we had the very disturbing reports of actual death threats being given to AG staff in Etegwini Municipality, which is where I'm from. Could you please comment on the level of that sort of thing? Is that hopefully a thing of the past, or is it still there? And if it is, could you give us a report on who was threatened and by who? Because I honestly think that either of our committees need to take something like that forward and actually report this sort of thing to the SAPS for follow-up. Because if your staff or your contractors are still actually being physically threatened or threatened with their lives or whatever, we got to stamp it out. So can you please comment on that? Thank you. If it is the case, if it's starred, then it's fine. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, your turn.
To ask the AG, yeah. Yes. Yes, and also to clarify just remarks in terms of the research that was done by the DA. I think, AG, I'll try and put it in the form of a question that we all know we're fighting from the same corner in the boxing ring to address the scourge of irregular expenditure. And what we've tried to do as a party is to establish, through the annual reports, the amounts that is in irregular expenditure that can lead to corruption, that can ultimately be a risk to the fiscus as we're nearing the medium-term budget policy statement within 2 weeks or so. So we were trying to establish, in terms of the different departments, what is the scourge of corruption, of possible corruption in those departments. Now, I can just, for your information, say that we have the 14 or 12 worst performers of those departments. The irregular expenditure tally that we have in terms of those departments is 61 billion. This is what we've researched in terms of the annual reports. And my question was, in terms of a clarification, whether the amounts that we have the differential on is with regards to a closing balance, or whether it was just with regards to one financial year, whether it was confined to that, and also whether there was perhaps a difference in cut-off dates. But I think what would be most helpful, and this is my question, whether the AG's office can provide us with the 12 departments that I have in terms of the irregular expenditure, what your view is in terms of the irregular expenditure. And let me take an example just of Eskom, with the irregular expenditure of 19.6 billion. Sunrail 10 billion, Transnet 8 billion, Department of Water Sanitation 6 billion, SABC 5 billion, Water Trading 4.9, and then Department of Corrections 3.2 billion. But my question is also with regards to SCOPA. If we can have from the AG's office a schedule in terms of all departments that have irregular expenditure of more than 1 billion, then we can make an assessment in terms of whether it was over a period of time or whether it was just for this financial year, and I think that would be most helpful. Thank you very much, Chairperson. No, thank you, Chair. I think we were going over the decade.
All right.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much, AG, for actually assisting us. I'm just requesting, Comrade Whip, that we should call the departments that have got serious issues to our committee. The AG is assisting us with information. I think we must do our part as committees of the legislature. The consequence is right in the ball is in our court. We must call the departments, we must make the necessary recommendations to the legislature, and I'm pleading that we do that as appropriation, because really we cannot appropriate funds and go on a summer holiday. We can't do that. We must follow the money. The money of the State of the Republic
has got to be used for what was planned for. Otherwise, we're getting nowhere. Thank you.
Right. Thanks very much. I'll hand over to the Auditor General to briefly respond to the issue. Safe to say, comrades, we had a right to ask questions, but we had been presented with figures, numbers, and trends. And I think our questions were really not zooming into what is in front of us that must assist us in mapping up our oversight process. Just to say, AG, that my sense, I think in line with what my last comrade has said, you are here to provide us with information. And it's for us to make use of that information. And I always get frustrated in public platforms, and radios or whatever interviews, where people out of frustration expect anybody to be anything. You say you're a scoper, but you have not arrested anybody. You have not fired anybody. It cannot be. Similarly, the Auditor General cannot be responsible for who has been fired, who has been disciplined. We seem to be running away from the real culprits. That is the DGs and the ministers. Those are the people who in law must act, and we're always moving around them. Always. And the reason we have this amendment to the Audit Act, it's an admission that the ministers and the DGs are not doing their work as per the PFMA. That's why I said for me it was shameful that there was a minister who voted for this amendment, because they were essentially accepting that they can't do their work, so they must shift that responsibility to the AG. So I'm just saying let's always have some bit of perspective. Lastly, there was the issue about the Accountant General, who is here. Yeah. I don't have a problem, comrades, hearing from her. But we may need to consider for ourselves that I think the question you've raised is very important. Not just having a response, but maybe having an engagement with that office and say, here is the report of the Auditor General. This is what it says about procurement. Now, can you talk to us? What is your relevance vis-a-vis this? You know, so that we don't, AG, get an example of one or two transversal contracts, and that's it. So I'm that's why I took some time. I'm really thinking whether maybe we should not consider that route. So I'll allow her after the AG if she has anything to say, but I just want to say that must not take away our right to call that office and say, here's the audit outcome. Where do you feature in? All right, AG.
Now, thank you, Chair. I'll deal with the last points that were raised very quickly. Honorable Ross, if you can give us the schedule that you have, we can help reconcile it, because we can already see, as you were talking, there were already three reconciling items. Just as you were talking ESCOM. ESCOM is not part of this analysis, but it's part of your schedule, even though it's a publicly owned entity. For historical reasons as well as for consistency, we wouldn't want to put ESCOM and then there's nothing to compare it to for previous years. Same as Transnet. So you can already see that we've tackled 60% of your reconciliation and where the problem is. And I think that's the sentiment I was expressing earlier on, that you might be doing the right thing but adding other things that are not historically part of what our analysis is. So no one can dispute the fact that what sits on ESCOM or what sits on Transnet as a regular expenditure is real. But historically for our analysis, because we don't audit those entities are edited by outside firms. And so we never bring them into this analysis for historical reasons. And perhaps that's where the issue is, and that's why we think that it's not a train smash, but we could be talking about the same things, but you've got more than what we traditionally have had. as far as the threats to auditors, Honorable Bretzer, the issue here received prominence, if you remember, when it reared its head in the KZN environment. Since then, as we were doing these statutory audits of the PFMA, we have not encountered a similar type of matters. The kind of contestations where the likes of your interpretation is not good enough. Let me show you what this thing means. And then it becomes that intense engagement, which is normally what happens in an audit. But other than that, we have not really been receiving any such. There are some isolated incidents, but there's one instance that happened recently which we believe was not really aimed at us, but we were caught in the fire. It was predominantly a supplier who was wanting their payment, but we happened to be in the spot with the auditee there, and our guys were just almost wrapped around with the auditee themselves. So it was not targeted at the audit. So those are the type of situations. You operate in environments that are a little bit hectic sometimes, and it's that's the nature of the issue, as it were, the hazard of the job, as it were. Someone could be coming to pick up their check, and they discover their auditors around. And sometimes they have a different interpretation of auditors. They sometimes think auditors are the guys who are supposed to authorize the department to make the payment, when in fact it's not. So I guess we experience those things in isolated instances. Maybe the other issue about the 30-day payment and the treasury. I think the issue here is the fact that treasury control over the activities as well as the projects. I mean, if you think about what could trigger a 30-day payment under normal circumstances. Normally, a 30-day payment could be triggered when the basic systems of internal control are activated and they function. Because nobody wants to pay somebody within 30 days also if the invoice is questionable or if the service itself is questionable. Now, 30 days is a very short period of time. And sometimes the deficiencies and the inefficiencies that we pick up through the audits also contribute to the extension of the number of days of payment. So there's a lot of interlinkages between these things. I mean, it's not a standalone. It also has got its dependencies on this. The middle management and delegations, once more, an accounting officer cannot escape what they have delegated. And Section 44 of the PFMA says so in very clear terms. So middle management, yes, is part of the picture, but there are very specific provisions in Section 44 of the PFMA which say all senior managers can be delegated to by an accounting officer, and these are the implications of those delegations. So everything that we look at, we often take it as the final accountability is the accounting officer, even if the accounting officer has delegated further functions to DDGs and chief directors and so on and so forth. So all of them, they basically get wrapped up around the accounting officer. But it's true. Middle management, if not empowered, if not given the requisite experience and expertise, will also fail in this job in the same way that an accounting officer will. Timely reporting, I think that one as well, Chair, again, Section 65 of the PFMA even gives us the reporting responsibility for those ones who have not submitted their accounts. So we suppose all of us to do what Section 65 prescribes in terms of the tabling to legislatures. And our case at the bottom of that section, we are required to also issue a Section 65 report which sets out the reasons for non-submission and all of that. The question is, once that has happened, because we used to do it in the past, but we never really see anything after it has been submitted. And maybe the last point, which I'll probably just canvas broadly, is how is the process going to work after these amendments are implemented? Currently, the way the process works now, before that eventuality, is that we audit at the end of July, we issue the audit reports, and in the period subsequent to that, we do the analysis and we interact with the different stakeholders. What we envisage will happen once these amendments are put in place, we are going to obviously sharpen even more the way we go about doing the audits, still on a risk-based approach, So the risk is that you might end up with an incorrect opinion as an auditor. So that risk approach to the audit will still apply. But what is going to happen at the end now? We're going to have a conclusion on the audit, but where there has been a material irregularity that has been identified, we will deal with it during the course of the audit by highlighting that material irregularity and making specific recommendations that will point an accounting officer to those sections of the PFMA that they are supposed to activate. If they don't activate those ones, that's when the proposed remedial action is going to come from the audit. Now, currently, that doesn't happen because we rely on them making their promise and meeting their promise. But in this instance, there will be formal process of issuing those that remedial action. What will be the action that we propose must happen if you did not fix those deficiencies? Some of these deficiencies could be that we don't have a budget to do what we propose we must do. We were only promised the budget in 2 years' time. Those are the type of things that we will put in our report, because this amendment also comes with reporting responsibilities on our side. As far as this issue is concerned of the possible issue of a certificate and remedial action, we'll be required to report on those actions and what has been fixed and what has not been fixed. So that will be the additional area of reporting that we will do. Not only will we focus on just the financial statements, but in our annual report, which we will send to SCOWEC, we will also have a status of matters that have been referred in accordance with Section 5B of the PAA as amended. We will list Department A had an irregular expenditure, for example, of 20 million. These are the steps that were proposed in terms of recommendation. Our follow-up indicates nothing has happened. We have therefore, based on the legislation, decided to issue remedial action, whatever that action will be. So there will be more transparency about what has happened in those. I think that's the extent to which we can assist in terms of when this amendment comes about. But I think, Chair, also what is important to note is that people react to an audit currently because they know that it may just disappear, that issue that has been raised after a while. But in a new dispensation where you've got this thing, it may not necessarily disappear. The issue will remain. So someone will start by knowing upfront that if there's a big finding on the audit, it may follow me, whereas currently it doesn't. I think that's where the distinct difference is going to come from. As again, it's not in our hands to act on it because we're not empowered to do so. But the matters will not disappear the way they currently do now. Thanks.
All right. Accountant General.
Thank you so much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Member. I'm going to more deal with the actions that have been put by National Treasury, in particular the Office of the Chief Procurement Office, to deal with the supply chain management. But first, what I would like to make the Honourable Members to understand is that throughout the years, the audit environment has improved and evolved, and monitoring has been enhanced in department. That has resulted in a lot of things that happened in the past, certain contracts that were entered in the past being brought up to check what was wrong. In some cases, you might think that the country is going down, only to find that those issues that were not raised in the past are now coming up and clear and being audited. Contracts that were entered wrongly up to 2005, they might have an impact on the audit outcomes of payments that have been made in relation to such contracts, where possible adequate controls were not in existence. And then also the other issue that I can talk to, we as National Treasury has also enhanced accountability and transparency by issuing certain account classification, where we found that certain amounts, certain funding or expenditure was hidden in transfers and subsidy with no identity of where the money was going to. So due to such, then it has raised a lot of findings for people to explain what was being purchased then, which is goes to billions, and that affects also the audit outcomes. But the intervention that National Treasury has done there is a public procurement bill that is in process to ensure that the chief procurement officer has got a mandate and has got authority to enforce certain regulations throughout the in all spheres of government. Then when it comes to also the supply chain, in South Africa general, we never had a profession or a proper qualification of supply chain practitioners, so that people who enter into the supply chain management environment, they are professionalized, they know what they are doing. So National Treasury has advocated for the professionalization of SM practitioners. There is an interim board that has been established currently that is going to look into the professionalization of this, because certain issues that we found are happening are due to ignorance. Because when you go to supply chain, you'll find that people who are in the supply chain are not having from any professional education or professional skill. They just happen to be promoted to get there without understanding prescripts and supply chain processes. So we are sorting that as National Treasury. We are working both the Office of Accountant General together with the Chief Procurement Office. We have set up that interim board. It will be work on it and found a proper profession for supply chain, so that people can be accountable for not doing things right, because they will know what it is that they have to do. Then the other issue that we are doing, we are improving by putting new regulations in terms of good financial management, and those regulations are assisting. And then lastly, lastly, I want to talk about transversal contracts. The transversal contracts, that's why Treasury, we moved as government from that decentralized to from centralized to decentralized. But in the process, we found that maybe there are no savings to government if we are decentralizing everything, because there are certain areas in government that needs central, especially when it comes to education and health products, because that is where we need proper vetted supply. So OCPO is more involved in that, to make sure that transversal corner, to ensure that the type, the quality, there's quality assurance, there is also reduction in the corruption on buying certain critical products that the state will use, and also ensure the integrity of service provider. Hence, we have a centralized supplier database that is managed by the chief procurement officer, to make sure throughout the country, whoever does business with the state is registered in that central supplier database for integrity and vetting.
All right. Now, Thanks very much. I think I would not prefer that the input should arouse a discussion, because the actual people that we need to engage with is the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. On their work vis-a-vis, because their work must have an impact on what the Auditor General finds. So whatever they do, they can list 100 things that they've done, but if it does not impact on this, then maybe the bullet is not silver. I think that's the question from that arises from what you have said. I think what the Accountant General spoke to, we can always deal with that in the report that Treasury sent to us every January on compliance with the PFMA and other stuff. But maybe public service and administration, because when she said we must professionalize these people, most of them is ignorance. It raises the question, how are people placed into positions of responsibility when they don't know what they're doing? You know, so, but I think that's a discussion for another day, that we,
especially in Scope, may need to look into. AG? I'm not sure. I think there was a question from the chair on outstanding audit and the possibility of auditing 6 months. I think those were missed. And then we will bring this engagement to a close.
Oh, Chair, yeah, I did speak to the outstanding reports and made reference to Section 65 as the requirement in the PFMA, which is often not followed through. And then on the 6 monthly audits, that status of records review, Chair, is close enough to the 6 monthly engagement of the accounts. Close enough in the sense that it will be difficult to do a statutory audit halfway through the year because of all logistical type issues. But we've tried to use the status of records review as a way of doing that half-year audit, in essence. Although it doesn't come with an opinion, but what we have said in developing this mechanism was that should we find sufficient issues that require to be addressed based on what we see in the accounts for the first 6 months, we will also extract a report that will be sent to oversight, to appraise oversight of those matters. We will also appraise the executive authority of those matters once we have seen through. For example, it could be that there are 20 accounts in the books, but there's no evidence of any one of them having ever been reconciled since the beginning of the financial year. That is a red flag for things to go wrong come the end of the financial year. So that is the extent to which this 6 month we can play a role, but not to do a full-on audit. Otherwise, it could require additional resources.
Okay. That's fine. Comrades, there is this stakeholder satisfaction questionnaire. Please, let's fill it before we leave. Comrade Chair, let me hand over to you. Okay, just a minute. Yeah.
Honourable members, we have very interesting engagement between ourselves and the Auditor General. And I'm sure you will agree with me that the Auditor General has done its job with great diligence. And it is true that we have now information, reliable information, that we can best use in our engagement with the departments. You know, auditing 434 institutions is not an easy task. As Parliament, we highly appreciate your hard work, and you are the only supreme audit institution in the Republic. And we are very happy that after today, I don't know whether I heard you correctly, you will now have teeth, you know, too. I promise you. I think that's how we're going to address this consequence management, which is lacking in other offices. So at least we have you, and I hope God will give you strength and brevity to go ahead. The message about the limited improvement in audit outcomes and accountability is loud and clear. It calls on us as Parliament to take our work to greater heights. The challenges you presented before us are overwhelming. Out of 434, only 99 auditors received a clean audit. As the Appropriations Committee and also our friend here, because after this, we're going to meet and discuss a collaboration strategy. Because it's clear we need one so that we can do more. You know? So we are concerned about the reported underspend on infrastructure grants because it undermines the agenda of creating jobs and growing the economy and reducing poverty. And it's not what we're saying. It is written loud and clear in the NDP, National Development Plan, as a one pillar to assist us in this. But now the underspending is really undermining this. A jump from 757 million to 2.5 billion in fruitless expenditure is something that Parliament cannot tolerate given the constrained fiscal environment. And then 50 billion of irregular expenditure is too much. It's just too much. It is unacceptable that departments and entities simply ignore the PFMA and other applicable prescripts. We are confident that amendments to the National Audit Act will help to reinforce Chapter 10 of the PFMA, which outlines provisions for consequence management. The onus is now on us as public representatives to find ways of dealing with the reported challenges using all instruments and venues at our disposal. Thank you very much, and thank you, Chair, for running the meeting so professionally. Thanks.
All right, I die. Let's try. The meeting is over.
Okay.